If everyone will give me their attention, I'm Jack Bass and I'm merely the moderator. But Joe Butwin, who is Joseph Mazo Butwin, now a resident of Seattle, will tell the story of his uncle, Earl Mazo, who flew 32 missions over Europe as a B-17 pilot before joining the Stars and Stripes, which was the newspaper for the everyone in the military. He later became one of the top newspaper reporters in the United States.
That's it?
Well, let me add one thing. He is professor of English and Jewish studies at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Wow.
Is this working?
Yes.
I like to think that I can fill rooms like this without it, and I can. Still feels funny. I want to say that right now we're observing the 70th anniversary of the victory in Europe, first week of May 1945. But I would give a moment of reflection, and you can do it hereafter, to the fact that it's the 72nd anniversary of the final days of the Battle of the Warsaw Ghetto, when finally on May 8th, 1943, I was about to be born safely in the safest place for a little Jewish kid to be born in the world, St. Paul, Minnesota. I mean, Charleston was a port. Charleston was, you know, under surveillance. St. Paul was not. But my mother was born, and Earl Mazo and my Aunt Norma, the generation of people we're talking about, the very people, in Warsaw, on Gansha Street, which is now called Anielowicz, named for a freedom fighter, we could honestly call him, a ghetto fighter who died probably on May 8th, 1943. Not entirely clear, because he was in a group that was, the polite language was eliminated on that day or the day before. So remember Jewish resistance in Warsaw, and if you should visit that city, you would find that the street called after Anielowicz, Mordechai Anielowicz, I love that, the son of an angel, Aniel, was right across the street, or I should say on that street, and the reason it was given his name in his honor was that the Germans made a little concentration camp, an urban concentration camp, at the Genskaya, of the prison on Gansha Street, which was right across from where my mother and Earl and Norma grew up. Looking down, my mother describes in a childhood diary, looking down at the prison, which was strangely also a German prison during the First World War, reapplied in the second. So part of my interest in my uncle, and I want to defer to my two cousins who are here, Mark Mazo and Judy Mazo, his daughters. I feel a little funny up here as a kind of a surrogate for them, but I honor my uncle, and I hope to the same degree that they do, is that for a lot of the Jewish soldiers, including my uncle, the trip to Europe was a return to a Europe that actually very few Jewish immigrants made under any other conditions. In other words, among immigrants in the first two decades of the 20th century, a big period down to the First World War, in some groups, say the Italian in 1910, as many Italians went back to Italy and indeed had come with that as a goal, a reasonable goal. to earn a little money and go back to Italy and lead an Italian life. That was not uncommon among American immigrant groups. Among Jews, the number to return was less than 3%. In other words, few Jews were to return to Europe, except occasionally between two wars as tourists with those wonderful tools, the Kodak, to have pictures taken in the village and then come back. And I'd be curious, hard to get numbers on this, for how many soldiers was the trip to Europe a return to Europe? My uncle was born there and he returned as a soldier. Much of what I would want to say is written into the program, and so I think I'll let that speak for itself and defer to my to other surrogates, basically, because we all stand here representing people who aren't here.
Gail Siegel Messerman and Herb Knobbitt, both of Hilton Head.
Kiowa.
Hilton Head.
A little competition there, actually.
My pardon. Gail Siegel Messerman of Kiowa and Herb Knobbitt of Hilton Head are both natives of Walterboro. And they'll be telling the story of their father, Sam Siegel of Walterboro.
I go first, huh? Well, I grew up in Walterboro, and I've been away.
Hold it close.
Do you hear me?
No. Hold it close.
Holder? Is that?
No, it's got turned green.
It is green. No?
It is on.
It is on?
Hold it close.
Hello, hello?
Yeah, hold it close.
It feels good to be back in the South because it's the only place I've ever lived where people go, oh, you're Gail Siegel. Because I haven't been Gail Siegel for a very long time, so it makes me feel at home. I was just thinking about my dad when I was coming over from Kiowa, and I think the story of how my sister Penny and I, and my brother Paul, and my uncle Herb, got involved in thinking about his tour of duty in the war was when we discovered that he not only kept a diary every day from the time he was 17, he was 19, which was probably in 1934. He was 19 until the day he died in 2007. So you can imagine we have many volumes of his daily writings. But when he died, it was really the first time we had ever looked through the diaries. They were private to him. And so we gathered them into a trunk, and they sort of landed in our home. And Penny and I have gone back and forth rummaging through the diaries, but mainly about, we were looking for things about us, when we were born, what he thought of us, what he thought of mother, when he first dated mother. Those are the things we were interested in. And then one day I was sitting down and I started just looking back. And I was stunned because he kept a diary every day during the time he was fighting in Europe. He was keeping a diary when he was in a foxhole. He was writing the day he was badly wounded. He was writing our mother every day from the Battle of the Bulge. Then the first thing I thought, how in the world did he keep these pages dry? Because he was in deep snow, he was in mud, he was in rain. And I went back a little further, and on the day he left, the only thing he said is, I think I'll take some extra clean sheets of paper when I go. And he must have taken a lot of clean sheets of paper because his writing just goes on and on and on. And it's a remarkable legacy to certainly those of us who knew and loved him, but maybe to just everyone, because he was pretty incommunicative about his time in the war, it's at least with the children. It wasn't anything he really wanted to share with us, I guess. And we weren't, I guess, interested enough to talk, but to ask him. But I think it was his private time or his private part of him. The person that he really shared most of his war memory with was his brother-in-law, Herb, with whom he had a very special relationship. But my dad, I think, going up to the time when he knew he would be drafted, spent a lot of time writing in his diary about what was happening in Europe. And the one thing that interested me, and certainly my husband Jerry, was how early he was quite aware of what was happening to the Jews in Europe. I mean, from the early days of his diary, he was a little Jewish boy from Anderson, South Carolina. And they weren't very sophisticated people. It's a small mill town, a lot of anti-Semitism, but he must have been listening to the radio every day, because every day, Kristallnacht, he wrote about in his diary, he seemed to know every day some atrocity that the Jewish people were undergoing, and it was very moving to me. He was also extremely Jewish in Anderson, South Carolina, which kind of surprised me, because in later years he was not extremely Jewish, but he was very active in the temple and writing plays and writing poetry, which was another thing I was not really that aware of, is how much of a writer he was. Although I should have known, because every day of my adult life when I was away from Walterboro, he wrote me a letter every day. And he wrote Penny every day. And he wrote my brother Paul every day. Did he write you? He wrote Herb every day. Did he write you every day? He did. But the letters weren't particularly full of world events, but they were full of love and grace and all the good things. But the thing that I think is most touching about what I've gotten from the diary, and some of his pages of the diary are upstairs, it was that he never really felt put out by being there. He hated it and wanted it to be over, and he missed us. But I always got the sense from just those pages that he knew it was where he should be. And I think he was very proud to be Jewish. And he was proud to fight for America. And although he was very concerned about the Jews in Europe, he was a real proud American. And he... that was the thing that I think he brought back from the war, much more than the horrors that he experienced. And there were many. I mean, he had a very bad injury, and he ended up losing his leg significantly above his knee. And it affected his entire life. He had to learn to walk. He taught other people to walk. But I think that the thing that made him the proudest was Walterboro and the life he lived, and the fact that he fought for this country. And I think that's my best memory of him. And if I could remember anything about him, it would be his incredible love of life and how proud he was to be able to, I guess, share his life with other people, especially people who were less fortunate. I think he was a really good Jew, a really true Jew, and he cared about people less fortunate than him. And he always told people if they were going to Europe that if they ever got in Belgium, if you get to Belgium, look for my leg, because that was what he wanted brought back. Now, Uncle Herb.
As Gail said, I became pretty close to my brother-in-law, especially later in life. In fact, every other Sunday morning, I'd get up at 6 o'clock, I'd hit the road from Hilton Head, I'd drive the hour and a half to Walterboro, spend a minimum of an hour and a half with him, and drive back. And these were very special to me, and I think to him also. And I didn't realize that Sam never spoke about the war to hardly anyone. But then after he read Ambrose's Citizen Soldier, which I had read, he started talking about it with me, and we shared quite a few things. I'd ask him questions, and I got a little confused because some of the things he told me were what people in his unit told him. But what happened to Sam was he was in something called the 78th Infantry Division. And the 78th Infantry Division, he was drafted later in life. He was 28 years old, wasn't he?
Right.
28 years old and had had two children.
Two kids.
But still, they were so hungry for manpower, they started drafting people that age. And after boot camp, he went to England with the division. And then the division went into France and Belgium to get ready to go to the front. Well, they were in training, and it took several weeks for them to get trained at what they wanted to do. But in the middle of training, apparently the Battle of the Bulge started. Now, Sam, who had gone to the University of Georgia and had an education, became a clerk typist. He was one of the old guys, and they put him back in battalion headquarters. Well, as soon as the Battle of the Bulge started, Sam told me that they took everybody, the cooks, the people in the offices, and everyone else, and gave them guns and sent them to the front. And he said they gave him, I thought he said a 37-millimeter anti-personnel and anti-aircraft gun with one other guy, but it might have been a bazooka.
He was shooting a bazooka.
And he went to the front, and he fought in the Battle of the Bulge from just about day one, because the Battle of the Bulge happened starting about mid-December in 1944, and it lasted for about a month. And their division was not scheduled to go to the front for another couple of weeks, but Sam went to the front. And he told me some of the things that happened to him in some of the battles. And he got wounded about 4 or 5 months later and spent about 10, 11 months in veterans' hospitals. They tried to save his leg. They took off a piece at a time. And he ended up in Atlanta most of the time. And I knew Sam's contemporaries more than anyone else in the family, since I was probably the oldest left in Walterboro with him. And from Walterboro that he knew. And I knew a lot of the people he knew in Atlanta and people all over the place. I was born in Anderson and went to Walterboro when I was about 2 months old. And I had one uncle who was a pharmacist, and he was in hospitals during the campaign in Italy. My real father was joined the Navy right before the war started and ended up spending the time in England. I had another uncle who was a physician, and he was on Bataan and Corregidor, and he got captured with the rest of the Americans, and he must have been in the death march because they were all on the death march, and he spent the rest of the war in Japanese prison camps. And he came out of the war and went to veterans' hospitals because his mind was never right after that. He had lost from 190 pounds from they liberated him, 89 pounds. And it was horrible, but he survived it. And the family tried to take him out of the camps, but they couldn't. And I talked to him a couple of times, but he never told me anything about the war, and he didn't make much sense anyway. But Sam did. And I realize now how fortunate I was to have been one of the few people he ever discussed his exploits with. He never would talk to the family about him, like most of the veterans. But he was very frank with me, and he told me some of the things that really blew my mind. For example, he told me that the troops that he was with, some of the people that came in, the senior non-commissioned officers, had been in the recent battle of the Herchin Forest. He said things that were horrible over there. He said that, for example, he said in the forest it was bitterly cold, as it was during the Battle of the Bulge a few weeks later, and that the Germans would shell the trees and let the high explosives go off the trees, and the frozen branches were like spears. They killed American troops. And he said that his unit and the rest of the units and the people that were in the Herchin Forest in the Battle of the Bulge, that they didn't have decent winter uniforms. So what they would do is they'd break into farmhouses and steal sheets, and they would cut holes in the sheets and wear them like ponchos so they blended with the snow. He said the German troops all had winter uniforms, and they were all white, so you couldn't see them. But he said the American troops, he said, we just didn't have the right equipment. He said our equipment in the Battle of the Bulge and elsewhere was inferior to those of the Germans. Our great benefit was that we could produce thousands of them where they could produce hundreds. And he said that the German soldiers were so much they were different, the American soldiers. He said a German soldier would be given an order, and he would follow that order to the death. If they said, stand up by this tree, he wouldn't leave no matter what happened. He said American soldiers said, we could innovate. We could change. We could, we would do things as they came along, but not the Germans. And he discussed things like that with me and discussed a little bit about his injury. And he told me, too, I was going to England one time, and he said, he said, you're going to the continent? I said, no. He said, well, could you go? I said, well, I guess I could, Sam. Why? He said, well, can you go to Belgium for me? For what? He said, maybe you can find my leg. He said, I know exactly where it is. So that was Sam. And those times with him were precious. And I don't think I'd give anything for that. We became really good friends in the later years of his life. I was always kind of, not afraid of him, he was a big man, but I was always kind of in awe of him before that. And then later we became such good friends, so that was one of the most pleasant things I've ever done, and I wish that I'd done it. I wish I'd have gone every week instead of every other week.
Anyway. Wait a minute, Ed. Let me just introduce you.
Everybody knows you.
Give me the microphone.
He's got one.
He's a fancy guy.
I want to make sure I've got it turned on.
It's on.
It's on. All right, Edward Polyakov, who's a lawyer in Columbia and a resident of Columbia, will tell the story of his father, Dr. A. Ellis Polyakov, who as a physician spent much of the war tending the sick and wounded aboard the Huddleston, a U.S. Army hospital ship.
Well, thank you, Jack. It was enjoyable for me once I had the opportunity to do this research and write the article to see what information I could find about the five Polyakov sibling brothers from Abbeville. Now, I'm going to talk in more detail about Dr. Ellis Polyakov, who was actually my uncle. My father was Meyer Polyakov, but the five brothers, and here's a little sidelight I like to talk about just to repeat it and get it into history. The five Polyakov brothers from Abbeville attended the University of South Carolina over about a 16-year period, and they were not on a 5-year plan; they were on a 3 or 4-year plan. And all five of them, one at a time, lived in the same dorm room on the university campus. Bernie number 48. And how do I know that? Well, one reason we know that is there are contemporary articles written in the game. It's the Gamecock is the name of the Carolina newspaper. One article written in 1932 by Leroy Wont, who later became, my Darlington friends recognize that name, but he became a very distinguished attorney and judge years after his Carolina days. So that's one article, and then another one in 1936 chronicling this this interesting little story about that room. But on to World War II. So starting, the eldest sibling was Dr. Ellis Polyakov, and he practiced medicine in Abbeville his entire career, other than World War II, after World War II, a postgraduate service courses that he attended at Harvard. Other than that, he was beloved in Abbeville for many, many years because of his medical practice. Then the next two siblings in age order were my Uncle Marion and my father Meyer. They both served in what was called the South Carolina Defense Force. And I've got the little Kepi cap with SCDF on it that my father had. I have too, I guess you could say I inherited it, a very large pistol that was issued to my father as his duty would be to defend Abbeville and maybe Anderson, but it was issued a very large pistol, and my son Eli was there with me the day that I found it after my mom passed away. We found this large pistol in the house. It frightened me. I called the city police chief to come handle it and see if it was loaded. And my mother's name was Rosa, and he said, "My, my, we never thought Miss Rosa had a big gun like this." But anyway, that was Uncle Marion and Meyer. The next brother in age was Arthur Bud Polykoff, who was a pharmacist after the war. He served in, he was stationed in England for more than 3 years in the pharmacy corps. And then the youngest sibling was Samuel Polykoff, who was also a physician. He being the youngest, by the time his military, he was dispatched to Korea at the end of World War II. In fact, it's an interesting memento upstairs. He was dispatched to Korea. He happened to be on a plane, a United Airlines plane, on VJ Day. And later, everybody who was on a United Airlines plane on VJ Day was mailed, and we got the envelope. It came in, a little trinket that commemorates the fact that they were on a plane on VJ Day. So he served in Korea. Both Uncle Ellis Polykoff, the eldest, for whom Eli's name, and Dr. Samuel Polykoff were both graduates of what was then the Medical College of South Carolina, and they loved their days in Charleston. So the diary, the diary that I had the opportunity to look through was the diary kept by the oldest, Dr. Ellis Polykoff. And in I found only one diary. I don't know if he kept others. The diary that we found was basically from in the fall of October 1944 through December of 1944. Has some interesting to me entries, most of which are outlined in my article. I don't know if he kept diaries. I'm assuming that he did for other periods of time in his service. I wish I had the diary. If he kept one, then I wish I had the diary in 1945 when General Eisenhower, visited the ship to which he was assigned. He was on the USS Huddleston, which was based in Charleston. Because I've found the video footage of it. Was a huge big deal when General Eisenhower went anywhere, and when he went to this Charleston Base Hospital ship in Cherbourg, France, where I know my uncle was for a time. That it would be interesting to read about that, but I don't have it. All the brothers were close, and it's touching for me to read how in my Uncle Ellis's diary entries he talks about several times he expresses the hope that the hospital ship that he's on that's going back and forth across the Atlantic will get close to Bristol, England, because he knew that his brother Bud was stationed at Bristol, and sure enough, through some lucky chance diversion of the ship, It did get diverted to Bristol, and so my uncle writes in his diary, "Just think, I came over 3,000 miles across the ocean, and of all places I could have gone, I land near enough so we could meet." And then he details how happy he was to meet up with his brother. And I didn't write about this, but the diary recounts a lot of just the difficulties back then of like making a phone call, things that nowadays would seem to us to be impossibly complicated to get permission to make a phone call, or to get from point A to point B, or to get from Charleston back to Abbeville on buses, plural buses, because he had to catch a bus at the port of Charleston that would go to some other place, and he'd change and get up to Abbeville. Details how the bus drivers were solicitous of Army personnel and would find a seat on them. Apparently the buses were all packed then, but the bus driver would always try to see to it that that he found a seat. Another touching part, and I covered some of those, was he recounted, Ellis Polykoff recounted Jewish services that he helped to organize. He wasn't the only one to organize, but he was involved in organizing Jewish services on the hospital ship. On Yom Kippur of 1944, there is this rather terse entry, something that we don't have to deal with on Yom Kippur. So he says, fasted all day. We had services, this is on Yom Kippur, we had services this morning at 10 a.m., again at 2:30 p.m., and again at 7:30 p.m. Boat drill interrupted the 2:30 services. So that's one thing we don't encounter. Another entry was at the port of Charleston. Again, this hospital ship was based there. He writes that tonight Mr. Shulman brought four bottles of wine for the Jewish boys for Friday services. He represents the Jewish Welfare Board. Professor Puckett mentioned that. Jewish Welfare Board in Charleston. Now, this is interesting. Here's an example of cooperation between Catholics and Jews in connection, because he writes, I had to go to the gate to meet him, referring to Mr. Shulman, as he wasn't allowed inside the port unless he showed special passes. Lieutenant Colonel O'Connor, parenthesis Father O'Connor, drove me to gate and back. So that was some nice cooperation. There are other entries where he describes the sights of Charleston, some of which are still, well, nothing changes here, so they're all still here. names change, because at one point he says, down the river we sailed, watching the Charleston shoreline. Under the Cooper River Bridge, or Grace Memorial Bridge, as it is now called, and then he went on to describe things. And then at the end of this entry, and now this is something to think about, on we sailed out through the submarine nets and into the wide Atlantic. So think about submarine nets, you know, a mile away from here, protecting Charleston from submarines. That was life. So in closing, the last thing I'm going to reference here is he had leave during the Christmas season of 1944, leave time to go back to Abbeville. This is in, again, December 1944. And he writes, one thing I noticed which stood out to me after being around the sick and wounded was the fact that no one seemed to be thinking of the war. It also seemed that everyone had somebody in the service somewhere. I suppose many had heavy hearts and were just masking their feelings. It was also at the time the Germans were pushing forward. This is, of course, Battle of the Bulge. And he ends, probably it's best to be this way and not think too much of the war. So after the war, he returned to his medical practice in Abbeville, beloved by all of his patients and the people in Abbeville. So thank you very much.
Alan Reiner, Jr. of Columbia, will tell the especially chilling story of his father, Alan Reiner, Sr.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack. First of all, I want to thank Dale.
Excuse me.
I want to thank Dale and Alyssa for putting up with my edits or whatever. Being an attorney, went through a few drafts, but I appreciate it. And with Dale, as you know, you get Ted. Ted was great with a few things. I think the title of the little piece I wrote was H's for Hebrew. And for those of you who haven't had a chance to read it, the Jewish soldiers had H on their dog tags. So I may feel a little different than our esteemed professor. Victim. Who, with my father being sent over to fight a war 2 years after we knew about the camps and being a prisoner. But because he was identified with an H on his dog tags. But I thank you, and also you can't be in this room without thanking you can't be in this room without thanking Marty. It's always good to be here. My father was a combat soldier, and like Gail's father, he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he rarely talked about it, almost never. He just wouldn't discuss it. The only time he ever really talked to us about it was we were traveling in Germany in 63, and we were in a car that was an American car. It was our car that we'd taken over there, and we had a terrible wreck over there, and I think some people were killed in the wreck, although my father never knew. I was 13 at the time. And after the wreck, I saw my father being subjected to German authority again. And as a young man, it was a really kind of tough experience to see your father very scared, very apprehensive. And we got out of there as quick as we could. He was lucky there was a German behind him that spoke fluent English and vouched for him that the accident wasn't our fault. And that night we ended up in Paris, and he talked about it that night. I think just you can imagine the emotions just came back. Just all at one time. But I was fortunate enough, although he died at a very young age, at age 49, he left us some memoirs that I found later. And they were written at really the urging of an old family friend, Julian Hennig Sr., who said, write it down. And so he wrote it all down, but it was tremendously understated. It was almost like there were two different experiences, even though this experience that he wrote down was absolutely factually accurate. But he didn't ever talk about what I guess is, the only way I can say it is probably the Jewish issues here. How he was captured in the Bulge, how he was segregated, how he was sent to a subcamp of Buchenwald. No word of that in here. And I never really knew that. I don't recall that night in that hotel in Paris him talking about it. But at any rate, he was an infantryman. Gail, and real high rank, private, first class.
That's what my dad aspired to.
He was a machine gunner. And for those of you who know the history of the Battle of the Bulge, Dad was at a place called St. Vith. And St. Vith was further towards Germany, north and east, than Bastogne. Everybody's heard of Bastogne. Well, Dad was in the 106th Division. He was in the 422nd Regiment, up on what they called the Schnee Eifel, which was snow mountain, snow range. And, I mean, that the Germans just hit them with Panthers on, what, the dawn of December 16th.
Yeah.
And it was totally surprised. The accounts of it, I've heard they were outmanned, outgunned, anywhere from 2 to, I've seen some accounts of 9 to 1. You got to discard that. But they were just cut up. I mean, they were just captured, cut up, everything. So anyway, they fought for 4 days there. And at the end, it was just awful. Their own own artillery was shelling, just terrible. And I quoted a passage in the latest edition of what it was like the last day for him. But at any rate, they were captured there, and they were marched for 4 days without food. And I thought I'd read from his memoirs what happened. This was right after being captured. And there were, oh gosh, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 went to this one particular camp. This is my father's words. That was the most, excuse me, I've got choked up. That was the most terrible trip anyone can imagine. We went 4 days without food and very little to drink. The only way we could get water was to bribe a guard with cigarettes. We had a small box for our excrements, but that was soon full, and in spite of our efforts, the car got filthier with every hour. Added to this, we were strafed and bombed every day by Allied planes. Our car was one of the few ones not hit, but many men were lost in other cars. Picture this, 68 men in a boxcar, 4 days, no food, and your own people are bombing you. Again, I take a little bit of issue with Professor Lichtman. If our planes could hit boxcars, they could hit crematorium. But I bring a very strong bias to that situation. He was taken, finally they get off the boxcars, and he ends up at Bad Orb. Now, some years ago in 1995, many of you know of Charles Guggenheim. He did a documentary on basically my father's experiences. He was in Dad's unit and didn't go over there. And then he heard what happened to the Jewish prisoners, and it haunted him. And he did a wonderful, wonderful documentary. And Dale's seen it, Ted's seen it, and it was really something. But there's a scene in that documentary, and this was a normal POW camp. One of the fellows there says, 9B was a gruesome place. And it was terrible. Well, as I mentioned before, if you were Jewish, you had an H on your dog tags. Okay? This is 44. This is really 45. Because he's captured on the 19th of December. And it takes 4 or 5 days to get there. And then to get in. But anyway, during 45, he's got an H on his dog tags. Catholics had a C, Protestants had a P. And a lot of Jews came forward when they asked them. At Bad Orb, they asked all the Jews to step forward. And some did, some didn't. They then segregated the ones that did. And let me back up a second. I ended up getting a call some years in 94 or 5 from a retired Army chaplain who started telling me these stories. He was at 9B. And it led me to the people that were sent to Berga, which is where my father was sent, to the Jewish prisoners. Well, it wasn't just Jews that were sent there. There were Christians sent there as well. But anyway, in talking to, I guess I spoke to some 25 of these people. that were there with my father. Of course, all of you will appreciate this. You know, you wonder, how did they know they were Jewish? Was the first question. I find out about the dog tags. What about people that threw their dog tags away? I talked to a survivor that's still alive right now, not from there, but from the Bulge, Jewish survivor, said the very first thing he did when he got hit, and he was hurt very badly, was he took his dog tags off and threw them as far as he could. Well, anyway, my father ends up being segregated. Interestingly, a fellow by the name of Ed Roper from Lake City, a pharmacist, they called him Doc Roper, who lived really close to us, got thrown in that same barracks. I said, Ed, you weren't Jewish. What happened? He says, well, the damn Germans, like, ran out of Jews, and I just happened to be in the wrong barracks. And he had the same experience that my father had. And anyway, he said to Berger, it's a slave labor camp. It's a subcamp, a Buchenwald, run by the SS. He gets there again on the boxcars, 4 days on the boxcars. He gets there. It is awful. It is basically they're commissioned to work in an underground factory, not a factory, digging tunnels. They're living on about 700 calories a day, and they're just dropping like flies. Well, one night during an air raid and a blackout, my father and another fellow, and he says it in these memoirs, he says, we simply jumped in the river. I mean, go figure. This is early March, late February, in the coldest winter in history. We jumped in the river. So they're on the run trying to get back to Allied lines for 6 days. Me, in reading this, I think what really happened there, because the men were being starved and worked to death. And if you really want to see something, look at that Guggenheim documentary, because there are accounts of these people talking about what happened. People would escape, they'd come back with a bullet in their head. Or one story, there's a medic there tending to someone they've been starved to death. They're on a ladle suit and a per man and a loaf of bread for six men a day. And they're working 10 hours. I said in the little article that my father weighed less than 95 pounds. Most accounts held it at 80 to 85 pounds when he finally escaped for the second time. But anyway, he was recaptured. But thankfully, during those days he was on the run, they stole chickens, eggs, milk, and I think it probably saved his life. The last escape was really at Liberation, and it really wasn't an escape, although a friend of his tells a slightly different story, and he swears my father told it. But if you'll recall, the Russians were coming from the east, the Allies were coming from the west, and the Germans are just in total disarray, and they're abandoning the camps. Where's Ted? Ted not here, but they're abandoning the camps at that time, and because the Germans don't want to be caught by the Allies, because they know the tables are going to be turned on them. So they're on a forced march. Now remember, these soldiers now are weighing 80, 90 pounds. 16 day period, they cover 350 miles. 50 of them die on the march. And this is no exaggeration. If you were to Google Berger and Google Bataan, they are compared. One got a lot of publicity. One was kind of a hidden story. 50 of them die on that march. And I guess 6 days before liberation, my father and some others, they're all sleeping in a barn. They hide under the hay that night. And the Germans can't find them the next day, and they leave without them. Because remember, the Germans are, at this point, the Germans know they can't continue to treat them this way. And they were really scared for themselves, because they could hear, as you read in here, you could hear artillery fire constantly then. My dad's friend says my dad told them that they were driving pitchforks all through the hay, which gives it a little more sensationalism and everything. I don't recall that. But at any rate, in fact, again, my father understates it tremendously. I'll read to you, if I can get through it, the last part of it from his memoirs, because it was hard for me. On the 16th day of the month, and that's April 16th, my patience grew to an end, and I made my second escape, this one successful. We hid under the straw in a barn in which we were sleeping, and as the guards couldn't find us, we were left behind. At that time, the Germans were in greater flight than we were. So on April 23rd, we walked into Allied hands. This is the hard part for me. That morning, we were lying in a field when we suddenly saw a group of Germans running toward us amid bursts of gunfire. We thought it was all over for us. Then right behind the Germans, we saw American half-tracks racing after them. They passed us, saw us, and that was it, our liberation. All we could do was cry. I don't know what else. I will tell you another little vignette, I guess. Unlike me, my father was blessed with a very nice voice. And remember, he was captured the 19th of December, and you get a telegram. I mean, boy, you talk about sterile telegrams, unfeeling, from the Secretary of War or some assistant person. Your son is missing in action. Stop. No further information available. Stop. We will notify you once we know more. Stop. That's about it. Something like that. Let's see. His parents don't hear from him till sometime after April 23rd. He writes a letter that it's in here that we found to them on April 24th from a hospital. And interestingly, and it's something that is a mystery to me, it's written on a Jewish sorority's letterhead. Sigma Delta Tau. And I talked to my good friend, Morris Klein, who lost a leg.
As
Gail's father did. I said, tell me about this. What? He said, Alan, I think your dad, and they went in, by the way, they had serial numbers one apart. And the families were close and they followed them stateside. He said, I think he put it in his liner of his helmet. I said, Morris, couldn't. I mean, not and go through what he did for all those months and everything. He said, Alan, you'd be surprised. I had a picture of Betty Grable in mine and it looked pretty good. But anyway, getting back to my father and his voice, of course, and we found so many letters when you were talking earlier about anti-Semitism and stuff from prominent Christian South Carolina families where the mothers, my grandmother, his mother, and they'd run into each other in the grocery store. And, you know, and it was always, where's Robert? Is Robert still here? Robert said, he used the term, the boys. They always referred to them as our boys and everything. And everybody was pulling together. And you see all these letters from people, you know, we pray your boy is safe and all this. But anyway, coming from a very small congregation, I guess we had what, Jack? 100 people at Tree of Life then at most?
200.
Now, but not in the 40s. Dad gets back, and because he had a voice, and this is what one of the old timers told me, he signed Carl Didray. And there was not a dry eye in the place. So, thanks.
Joe Buckman would like to make just one further comment.
I'm enormously moved by these accounts, and what Alan was just saying echoes something that an experience in slightly different terms that my uncle would have had at the same time. It's important to remember how relevant documentation is. We're here as historians, all of us, professional, not professional. I should say, incidentally, that at the University of Washington, where I've been teaching for 45 years, I will not get parking privileges until I retire. I wanted to say that. No, but it's true. Okay. As historians, we rely on documents. We also rely on hearsay and familial relations. And it's fascinating to hear these documents, the documentation of letters, a personal diary kept for 73 years, an account written after the fact that's as moving as that. My uncle was a journalist. I don't guess that he probably kept a journal. He was a journalist. His journal was written into newspapers every day of his working life. But that began here in Greenville and in South Carolina, and it continued after service in the Army Air Corps as a bombardier, 32 missions from England over Europe, and then as a writer for Stars and Stripes, and I've been reading his contributions to Stars and Stripes, just looking through old newspapers, and the byline, Earl Mazo, is coming from the front at every point, including the bulge. In other words, he was with Patton's Third Army. The difference between him and most soldiers was that he had a typewriter. And was generally not armed. But when the war ended, he had made a brief return and then returned to Europe and continued across Europe, in effect made the return that I was, that was the premise of my own original statement, that second return. But he returned to Poland via Germany. But en route, and I think right now, earlier I asked if my cousin Mark would read a letter that he wrote, because for the same reason you were having trouble, I was actually kind of convinced, Mark, that I would, but with your permission, he wrote a letter to his mother on August 6th, 1945. War in Europe, over in May, as we know. August 6th was, of course, what he couldn't have known, was the day of the bombardment of Hiroshima. But he was still in Germany when he wrote this letter on the 6th of August, and his stationery isn't a sorority, but the stationery of the Continental Edition of Stars and Stripes. Because he was a good journalist and not such a good typist, there are no capital letters. It's Archie and Mehitable, if you know those wonderful poems from the same period. Dear Ma, and this is written to Charleston, South Carolina. I wanted to tell you something that happened the other day in a little town near Munich. An old, stooped man was walking down the road carrying a heavy sack with a couple of blankets. He was bald and looked like he was about to drop under his load. German roads are full of that kind of sight these days. But this man intrigued me, so I stopped him and asked him where he was going. Bewildered, he pulled out papers and sputtered in German that he was not a Nazi, but a Pole, and had come from Dachau. I told him I was an American, and I wasn't going to hurt him. So he calmed down and told me he was a Jew, a father of five girls. He said when the Germans broke up his family 3 years ago in a little town near Warsaw, and remember, that's where Earl was born, in a little town near Warsaw, they sent him off to Germany, killed his wife, took his daughters for a German army brothel. He said he heard somehow that one of the daughters, 16 years old, had survived and was in a camp not far from a town outside Munich. He had walked 100 kilometers in 3 days trying to get to her. Mama. That Yiddish voice. Mama. We don't often do that in the middle of a letter, but I think that there's a reason here. The way that man looked and talked made me feel that my heart would burst. I said to myself, there, but for the bravery of Mama and Papa 23 years ago, goes I. Papa himself, if he could have survived, was this man, what this man, could he have survived what this man had gone through? Honestly, right there and then, while that man spoke, I sort of prayed inside me, thanking whoever was responsible for giving you and Papa the wisdom and strength and courage to get out of this European hell so long ago. You know, and Papa knows, how I feel about the way you people settled and with three kids, picked up, went to a strange land for us. God, I never appreciate it more than when I see what I see these days in Germany. I picked this man up, took him into town, put him up at a hotel where he could get a bath and a big meal, and I gave him every bit of money I had in my pockets, about $60. I realize now that might have been extravagant and foolish, but Mama, I couldn't help it. And I know that this is what Rita, his young wife, what Rita would have wanted me to do anyway, despite the fact that we need all our money now that we're having a family, the result of which is in the room, thank God. If only we could help all the thousands of people like that now. It seems such a hopeless task getting all those families together and settled again. Love, Earl.
Comment.
I have one quick comment to make. One thing I love about South Carolina and the South is when my brother-in-law Sam died in 2007, which was about 60 some odd years after the war. After the funeral service in the funeral home, we were driving to the cemetery. I rel up and I talk about this. I still do. And unbeknownst to us, the funeral cortege went down Main Street of Walterboro, where the store owners had put flags in the street, and the people stood with their hands on their heart for an American Jew 60 years after the war. I'll never forget that as long as I live. Thank you.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes, and I think rather than try questions now, I think we probably ought to go to the reception. Dale?
I wanted to ask Alan if he would talk about why he thinks his father was so reticent to say anything about what happened to him.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm glad you, and I think Carl Goldberg.
He's not.
Oh, he's not. Well, maybe Esther can add to this, or Henry as well. Did I hint at that when we talked during?
You told me what you told.
Oh, I did tell you. Okay. Well, I hope what I told you is what I'm going to tell again. I'm sure it will be. And this is hard for me, because, you know, you've got a picture. I lost my father at a young age, and, you know, that's not easy to start with. And when you're young, you don't, and especially after someone dies, they can do no wrong. It's just human nature. But I will tell you what I think all of those soldiers felt. First, they went over there right after D-Day, 2 or 3 months. And remember, D-Day was really the beginning of the end. And those soldiers at D-Day were vanquishing heroes. And my father and the rest of them felt the exact same way. We're going to kick some butt over here. And the next thing they know, this is hard for me, they were captured. But the real term is they were ordered to surrender. I can't use it. It's just too hard. But that's what happened. And these soldiers were really ashamed because they went over there to end this thing. And all of a sudden, there's a wonderful scene in the Guggenheim documentary of a fellow that is just so wonderful. He says, at liberation, I didn't want food. I wanted a gun. If I had a gun, I'm still a soldier. I wanted my dignity. And I think these POWs, one, it was a horrific experience, but two, they were ashamed to be captured. They really were. And for my father, it was even worse. They were put with, they use the term political prisoners. And these were mostly Hungarians and Slovaks, Italians, and I mean, complete with the striped pajamas and everything. They were treated exactly the same. They had no dignity. And when you put those two things together, that they weren't great liberators, and that in my father's case, all of their dignity was taken away, everything. I mean, they were reduced to animals, really. And I think is that basically what I told you?
Alan, I thought you said that there was an effort on the part of the American government to suppress what had happened.
Well, There was an effort there.
Repeat that into the mic so it can be heard.
Dale's question was, they didn't want this story to be told. The U.S. government didn't. Because if you'll remember, we had the Marshall Plan then, and all of a sudden our enemies weren't Germany anymore, it was the Russians. And this just got swept underneath it. And that was part of it. But I think a lot of it was the other as well. Yes.
My father-in-law, who was a veteran who was not captured, he just was over there, and he never ever spoke about it. And I think right. A lot of people, my father talked about it all the time. Like, he was told stories. I'm Judy Mason.
Right.
But
apparently,
that's right.
But I think a lot of the concentration camp victims had some of the same feelings. Is that?
Mm-hmm. I got a story about it.
Yeah.
I wish you would. Thank you. Quickly, my mother and her sister were both survivors and both came to Columbia. And my parents spoke freely about the Holocaust and what happened. But my aunt, my mother's sister, did not. And her son, about my age, doesn't know much about what his parents went through. And I asked him why one day. He said his parents purposely didn't speak about it because they were embarrassed, because they were prisoners, and they had these prisoners' uniforms, and they thought that if their children would think if they were in prison, then they did something wrong, and they were ashamed and embarrassed. They wouldn't speak about it.
That's so sad.
I think we're not going to have more questions, but I think everybody can stand and applaud.